Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. In the second half of our show today, we'll be bringing you part two of the 50th Congressional District debate between Republican Duncan Hunter and his Democratic challenger, James Kimber. But first, we'll have an update for you on the Ebola situation in Dallas, what you should know about the deadly disease, and what San Diego County's top health official has to say about how an Ebola outbreak would be handled if it happened here. We'll also have some great news about some new awards won by East County Magazine's reporting team. We'll have some information on new bills signed by Governor Jerry Brown to protect your privacy, as well as updates on gun bills and a plastic bag ban in California. You'll hear about a Hamul organization's efforts to save a second wild parrot that's been shot by a pellet gun. We'll have details on a cooking fire that displaced an East County family, and just how many cooking fires occur nationwide each year. You'll hear why the La Mesa Planning Commission just said no to the Park Station high-rise proposal. You'll hear about a suspected murderer arrested years after his wife's body was found in the Anza Borrego Desert. Plus, in Tribal Beat, we'll have news about a dramatic increase in Native American enrollment in California's public universities and why still more needs to be done to help Native American high school students prepare for college. Then we'll take you to Cuyamaca College for part two of the debate between Duncan Hunter and James Kimber, two veterans battling to win the 50th Congressional District seat. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
This is Ed Barrena with an announcement regarding the results from the San Diego Press Club's 2014 Excellence in Journalism competition. Once again, East County Magazine will be bringing home multiple awards. Congratulations to our seven winners this year who represent East County Magazine's online news site and our radio show on KNSJ. The winners include our breaking news coverage team, Tom and Nadine Abbott, intern Jessica Richmond, who worked on several major investigative news stories, father and son Mark and Corey Clement, co-hosts of our Wildest Jobs in East County feature on our radio show, Leon Thompson, who documented his recovery from quintuple bypass surgery, and East County Magazine editor Miriam Raftery. We don't yet know how many awards we will receive, or all of the categories, since only the names of the winners have been announced thus far. The winning entries will be announced at the annual Press Club Awards ceremony on October 28th at Jacobs Center. East County Magazine has previously received 69 journalism awards since beginning our news publication in 2008.
A search is underway for about 100 people in the Dallas area who may have been exposed to the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States. The man had traveled here from Liberia to visit his fiancée and went to a hospital when he became ill, but was initially sent home, exposing many to the illness. Several family members and people living with the victim are now in quarantine in Dallas, where officials sent a reverse emergency call to 11,000 area residents to warn them about the situation, including parents at four schools where several exposed children attended class. United Airlines has also contacted patients who were on board a flight with the man, although it is not believed that he was contagious while on board yet. Health officials have assured that Ebola is not airborne and it cannot be spread as easily as the flu or even the common cold. But here's some news you should know. If you come within 3 to 6 feet of a person with Ebola, you could possibly contract the disease. That's because droplets from a cough or sneeze can travel that far, the New York Times reports. Also, hugging or even touching an Ebola patient, or even the items that they have handled, can also transmit the illness through sweat and other bodily fluids. These details are troubling since it means travelers could potentially be at risk on a plane or a subway, in a hospital waiting room or other location if they're in proximity to someone with Ebola, a disease that has killed approximately half of its victims. In West Africa, the disease has sickened thousands in the worst Ebola outbreak ever. Travelers and residents of Africa are also cautioned that the disease can be transmitted by eating or handling bushmeat or meat from wild animals. The Centers for Disease Control has estimated that by January, the number of cases in West Africa could likely reach between 500,000 and 1.4 million people. Cases have been found recently in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Nigeria. The U.S. State Department has issued travel warnings for these areas. The disease originated in Zaire, now known as the Congo, but no recent cases have occurred there. There is some good news, however. Nigeria appears to have halted its outbreak. No new cases have been diagnosed since August 31st, and the incubation for suspected cases, which is about 3 weeks, has now passed. Earlier fears had been raised over the potential for a major epidemic in Nigeria due to crowded slum conditions. Now, as for that patient diagnosed in Texas, media reports have indicated that he might not have been truthful when asked before boarding a plane in Africa if he had been exposed to anybody with Ebola, although his family disputes that story. At the hospital in Texas, he did truthfully state that he had been in Liberia, but somehow the information was not passed along to doctors. Also, the patient's symptoms were not typical because he was not running a fever when he first came to the hospital. Now, since then, an NBC photojournalist working in Liberia has also tested positive for Ebola. He is the fourth American to test positive for the disease, and he's been flown to the U.S. for treatment. Two doctors who contracted Ebola while treating patients in Africa have also been treated in the U.S. One recovered and the other died. Ebola patients are not contagious when they do not have symptoms. The disease is fatal in most cases, and there is no cure, but experimental treatments with a drug made by a San Diego biotech company showed promise before the supplies ran out. So could an Ebola outbreak occur here? San Diego is home to thousands of African immigrants, but the vast majority of those are from East Africa, not West Africa, where the current outbreak is occurring. Still, the potential exists for a returning American or visitor to bring the disease to our region, as occurred in Dallas. County Public Health Officer Wilma Wooten assures that San Diego has containment procedures in place and that an Ebola epidemic in San Diego is very unlikely. City News Service reports that Wooten has indicated the local medical community has been alerted to be on the lookout for signs of the virus. These include fever, severe headache, muscle pain, weakness, diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain, redness of the eyes, and unexplained bleeding or bruising. Health workers are also instructed to ask anyone with those symptoms about their recent travel history. KPBS reports that the county's top health official says if a case of Ebola were to happen locally, the county of San Diego has well-trained staff that would investigate and locate any recent contacts of the person. Wooten adds, "We would need to find everyone who had direct contact with the person when they were showing symptoms and isolate these contacts if they were also showing symptoms to stop the spread of the disease." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law over a dozen bills to strengthen privacy and consumer protections. SB 828 aims to protect consumers from warrantless electronic spying on emails and phone calls. It prohibits any state agency from assisting the federal government in collection of personal electronically stored data with certain circumstances. In the wake of the leaked cell phone photos of nude celebrities, two bills, SB 1255 and AB 2643, strengthen protections for victims when sexually explicit images or videos are transmitted without permission. Responding to revelations that major retailers including Target and Home Depot had security breaches in which hackers obtained millions of credit card users' data, the governor also signed AB 1710, which requires corporations to offer consumers identity theft protection and mitigation services if their security is breached. AB 1732 prohibits vehicle dealers, distributors, and manufacturers from inaccurately advertising the vehicle's prior ownership or use. Other new laws aim to boost safety. One requires that upholstered furniture be labeled to disclose if it contains fire-retardant chemicals. Another requires limousines to carry fire extinguishers. Stalking victims will get new protections, and so will homeowners applying for reverse mortgages. Additional laws expand current regulations on invasion of privacy and require state agencies to post privacy policies in an obvious place on their website. For details and a link to the full text of these bills, visit the governor's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
For the second time in several months, SoCal Parrot in East County is caring for a wild parrot that has been the victim of a pellet gun. At approximately 7 p.m. on Monday, September 29th, SoCal Parrot's emergency hotline rang with a report from an Imperial Beach resident that a wild parrot was injured in his front yard. He believed it to have been shot with a pellet gun. A SoCal Parrot animal care coordinator, along with a trained parrot care volunteer, arrived on scene shortly after Chula Vista Animal Control. This yellow-headed Amazon parrot had a traumatic injury to its left wing. The parrot was transported to the SoCal Parrot Sanctuary and Rehab Facility in Jamul, where it received a thorough exam, followed by stabilizing care, pain medication, and overnight monitoring. The next morning, Dr. Todd Cecil of Pet Emergency and Specialty Center evaluated the parrot using digital radiographs. These showed two metal projectiles in the parrot's body and multiple bone fractures in the left wing. Dr. Cecil at SoCal Parrot will continue to monitor the bird's condition and evaluate surgical options, though it is not likely that this bird will ever be a candidate for release back into the wild, unfortunately. SoCal Parrot is a nonprofit whose mission is to bridge the gap of care and consideration for wild, naturalized parrots, and it's the only local organization working to help protect these endangered parrots that, while suffering in their native habitats in Mexico, are actually thriving here in Southern California. The yellow-headed Amazon is just one of 13 different parrot species that have naturalized in Southern California. It's considered to be an endangered species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, making the importance of each individual wild bird of enormous value to its species' future in the wild. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barrena reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. Cooking is the leading cause of home fires in the United States. Tuesday, a fire caused by unattended cooking displaced a family of five and caused $100,000 in damage to an apartment in El Cajon. It is considered a total loss. Heartland Fire and Rescue, with assistance from CAL FIRE, received a 911 call reporting the structure fire at 351 South Lincoln Avenue in El Cajon at 1:20 p.m. Fire crews arriving on scene found smoke coming from the door and window of a lower apartment unit of the two-story structure, the Lincoln 25 Apartments. About 15 firefighters had the fire knocked down in less than 20 minutes. The fire was contained to one apartment unit, but adjacent units did sustain smoke damage. Two adults and three children lived in the apartment. The two adults were home at the time of the fire and were able to escape. The children were at school. The displaced family of five is now being assisted by the American Red Cross. The National Fire Prevention Association and Heartland Fire and Rescue remind the public to never leave cooking food unattended. In 2011, the last year for which data is available, U.S. fire departments responded to 370,000 home structure fires. These fires caused nearly 14,000 civilian injuries and over 2,500 deaths and $6.9 billion in direct damage. More home fires are caused by cooking than anything else, followed by heating equipment. Two out of every five home fires started in the kitchen, and unattended cooking was a factor in 34% of home cooking fires reported. Two-thirds of those home cooking fires started when food or other cooking materials caught fire, and most occurred on a range or stove, with ovens accounting for only 16%. Microwave ovens are also a major cause of burn injuries due to scalding. Children under five face a higher risk of scalding than being burned in a cooking fire. Also, remember to test your smoke alarm and replace the batteries, since early warnings can save lives.
La Mesa's Planning Commission has voted to reject a plan that would have allowed Park Station, a proposed 10-story high-rise, to be built. By a 6-to-1 vote, the commission found the project to be inconsistent with the city's general plan. The hearing drew a crowd that spilled out the doors. The developer presented a revamped plan that was substantially scaled back from its original 18-story proposal, which would have included a hotel as well as condos and commercial space. But the cuts weren't enough to win support from planners, who recommended that the City Council deny approval for the project. Planners did, however, approve the environmental impact report. Urban Housing Partners claims to have 400 people who have indicated interest in living at Park Station or having a business or shopping there. But the majority of the 35 people who showed up and spoke were against the project. Sherman Harmer from Urban Housing Partners gave a presentation in support, contending that the landowner, Andy Kitzman, wants to leave a legacy for La Mesa. After the American Legion withdrew its support as a co-applicant, the developer dropped the height on a portion of the project, though other portions would still tower over the historic downtown district and the nearby hills. The latest proposal also added more parking and had fewer residential units in response to concerns raised over traffic in the neighborhood. Joseph Kitzman, speaking on behalf of the family that owns the property, said, "We've been here for four generations. Growth happens no matter what." The La Mesa Chamber also backed the project. A spokesman called it good for growth and overall betterment in the city of La Mesa. Also in support was Jim Stone, the executive director of Circulate San Diego. He noted that building in suburbs creates more traffic, and that building the project near a trolley line would, in his words, improve the quality of life. But those in opposition had a different view. Craig Maxwell, owner of Maxwell's House of Books in the downtown village, said merchants and others he's talked with have a uniformly negative view of the high-rise project. George Morgan showed computerized images created by opponents showing just how much the project would dominate the scenery if built. Aaron Amerling voiced support for preserving the small-town feeling in La Mesa, a town that recently celebrated its centennial, a sentiment voiced by many of the speakers. Suda House summed up the views of many here on the appropriate height for new development, stating, "No more than 4." Lily Feingold had this to say about the project. "To me, it looks like a giant human ant farm." After the vote, a representative for the Kitzmans said they will scale back their plans one more time, down to a maximum of 8 stories, but that's still double the city's height limit. The Planning Commission's vote is advisory, though, so ultimately the decision on whether La Mesa will retain its historic small-town charm or opt for urbanization will be up to the City Council. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Ed Barreno with today's Green Scene Report. California has become the first state in the nation to ban disposable plastic bags in major retail outlets, though 125 local jurisdictions in the state have already adopted similar ordinances. Governor Jerry Brown signed a measure into law that will ban the bags starting July 1st of next year in grocery stores and pharmacies. A year later, the ban will also apply to convenience stores and liquor outlets. Retailers will offer customers paper bags or a recyclable type of plastic bag at costs of 10 cents apiece or more. The plastic bags have been blamed for the deaths of marine mammals, birds, and sea turtles. The measure was supported by environmentalists who ultimately won support of grocers and unions with amendments to add training for workers transitioning out of the disposable bag-making business. Disposable plastic bag manufacturers oppose the measure. Governor Brown issued a signing statement indicating that the new law, quote, reduces the torrent of plastic polluting our beaches, parks, and even the vast ocean itself. He adds, quote, we're the first to ban these bags and we won't be the last, unquote. But the ban might not last very long. A group opposed to the measure has already filed papers to try to qualify an initiative to overturn the bag ban for the November 2016 ballot. If enough signatures are gathered over the next 90 days, the new law would be suspended until after the voters weigh in.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Leon Thompson with the Tribal Beat on East County Magazine. According to a report released Monday by Cal State San Marcos, enrollment of American Indian and Native Alaskan students at University of California campuses soared 67% between the fall of 2011 and the fall of 2012. But according to the study, less than one quarter of American Indian and Native Alaskan students meet University of California and California State University entrance requirements by the time they graduate from high school. The authors of the study suggested that greater efforts are needed to prepare American Indian and Native Alaskan students for college. The State of American Indian and Alaska Native Education in California 2014 study found that 24.9% of those students met University of California and California State University entrance standards, compared to 38.3% of the general student population. Greater efforts are needed to prepare American Indian and Native Alaskan students for college, said the authors, who are affiliated with the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center at California State University, San Marcos. American Indian and Alaska Native high school students are graduating at rate 6% below the state average for other ethnic groups, said the CICSD director and study co-founder, Jolie Proudfit. The study includes data on enrollment and graduation rates, dropout rates, and numbers of degrees conferred, and gives a breakdown of students by race and ethnicity. Proud Fit said. The steady decline in the overall annual enrollment rate of American Indian and Alaska Native students in the CSU seems to indicate that we are admitting more students, but they are dropping out. We are not retaining them once they get there. The report was made possible by a $500,000 grant from the San Miguel Band of Mission Indians, according to the City News Service.
Governor Jerry Brown has signed two bills to regulate firearms, but vetoed a third. Family members can now seek a temporary restraining order in court to block gun use and purchase temporarily by a person showing signs of mental instability. Assembly Bill 1014 was prompted by the deadly shootings in Isla Vista near UC Santa Barbara, where family members had warned law enforcement that they feared the suspect was planning violence. Victims of the Santa Barbara shooting had lobbied for the bill and cheered its signing. The bill was opposed by gun rights organizations. Governor Brown also signed Senate Bill 199 into law, which requires that toy guns be brightly colored. Recently, several young people have been shot by officers who mistook realistic-looking toy guns for real weapons. The governor vetoed Senate Bill 808, however, which would have required owners to register firearms that they make themselves. The measure was a response to new technology that could enable creation of guns on 3D printers, but the governor stated in vetoing the bill, quote, "I can't see how adding a serial number to a homemade gun would significantly advance public safety," unquote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
At the El Cajon Courthouse on Monday, a man accused of murdering his wife and dumping her body in the Anza Borrego Desert 7 years ago pled not guilty to the crime. Police arrested Anthony Edward Simonu in Hawaii earlier this month and extradited the former Navy dental assistant to San Diego County to face charges, the UT San Diego reported. His wife, Fumiko Ogawa, was last seen in January 2007 at the couple's home in Point Loma. Simonu never reported his wife missing and told neighbors she had moved to Hawaii. He had filed for divorce, 10 News reports, but delayed the action after his Japanese wife inherited a substantial sum of money. After she went missing, he reportedly went on a shopping spree buying boats, Land Rovers, and a Hummer. A few weeks after her disappearance, Ogawa's remains were found by a couple going camping in the desert. However, the remains were not identified until over 4 years later, in June 2011, and it took another 3 years to identify the suspect and build a case to bring him to justice. Judge Laura Hallgren set bail at $5 million. The next court date will be October 8th for a scheduling discussion. If convicted, Simonu could spend the rest of his life in prison. This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat report on East County Magazine.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. We are back now with part two of the congressional debate in the 50th Congressional District between Congressman Duncan Hunter, Republican, and his Democratic challenger, James Kimber. And if you missed part one, which was broadcast Friday on our show, you can find a podcast of it on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. In part two, the questions were posed by the audience in the debate, which was held at Cuyamaca College.
We're ready to move to round two, the audience-initiated questions. The first question picked from the audience questions will be given by Mr. Lynn and goes to Mr. Kimber.
Mr. Kimber, do you support the airstrikes against Iraq and Syria with ISIL, and do you support sending ground troops to either of these regions? What strategy do you support for dealing with ISIL terrorists?
The short answer is yes, I do support the airstrikes. I know Mr. Hunter did vote against it, and I actually understand his reasons for not wanting to arm rebels who we may end up having to fight someday with our own weapons and with our training. But the question is, if we're not going to do that, are we just going to sit by and let this happen? I mean, the rest of the world is looking to us for an answer and how we are going to respond to this problem. And we're now starting to build coalitions with the countries over there, the UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. I do not support putting boots on the ground, though, ever. But I think the bigger question is, if you're not going to fund this, and again, I understand his reason for not doing it, but then what is your solution? Because to do nothing is not an answer or a solution. It's not just going to go away.
Sure. Mr. Hunter.
So I'm confused. Number one, the vote that we had in the House was about arming Islamic Syrians who were considered rebels. It was not about striking in Syria or striking in Iraq. It was about the U.S. giving our technology and our weapons and our tactics and our communications gear to Syrian moderates, which I would argue don't exist at all. That's what I voted against. You can't do that and not have boots on the ground either. If you're going to train them, it takes Americans to train them. And what we're doing right now is doing what happened in Iraq and doing what happened in Afghanistan. I am totally for bombing the hell out of ISIS, crushing them and wiping them off the face of the earth, okay? ISIS, but that doesn't mean that you take Americans and put them in to hold ground in Syria or in Iraq. That's absurd. You're not going to have American military holding ground, fending off Assad and ISIS and all of these different groups. Let me tell you, the last thing that you do when you have a bunch of crazy warring factions going at each other, the last thing you do is arm them. Trust me.
30-second rebuttal.
I don't disagree. Again, I don't advocate putting any boots or soldiers on the ground. I understand what your stance is, and I understand the need for people who are instructing, but I'm talking about actual people fighting. I don't support that.
Mr. Hunter?
Let me close with this on this issue. The real threat with ISIS isn't what's happening over there. They have no Navy. They have no intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear tips. They have no Air Force. The only way that they can touch us here is by crossing our land border, by coming into the United States and planning attacks on Americans in this country. If you want to stop ISIS and make sure that they don't attack us in the homeland, then you kill them where they are. But you also make sure they can't come in through our southern border, because that's where it's scary. I'll tell you. Out of time. That's what's important.
Hey, we had a question from the audience, which I didn't see the card right here, but I'm going to follow up with. I remember it regarding the southern border. The question begins with Mr. Hunter and then go to Mr. Kimber. Since we have so many people in the United States who are undocumented, who've come in other ways than just to cross the border, people have come in visas and have stayed beyond their visas, is the southern border the number one line of defense we need to focus on, or do we really need to start looking at the people who are coming in through our airports, coming in through cruise ships, coming in through Canada, at least as much, if not more?
Absolutely. Yes.
So you prioritize that over the
elaborate
border?
No, it needs to be done the same. You have thousands of people that have gotten visas, student visas into this country and working visas, who just disappear. You don't know who they are. We're the number one entry point in the United States in San Diego for Somalis. The Somalis in Somalia know the name of the federal judge that grants asylum here in San Diego. They know her name over there. Because everybody knows that if you want to sneak in here, if you want to get into the U.S., and if you want to harm Americans, that's how you do it. You cross the southern land border. But you do have those outstanding student visas. You have the outstanding travel visas. That all should have been fixed post 9/11. But it was not. You had this big monstrosity called Homeland Security created, mm-hmm. which stops us all at the airport. But it does not make sure that people that are over here on visas have to go home on time. It does not make sure that student visas, that people with student visas have to go home on time. And that's what needs to be fixed on this. And you got to have a system, you're going to talk southern border, like E-Verify, where you make sure that every single person working in this country is a United States citizen. That means we're all on the same playing field.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Mr. Kimber, 1 minute.
I'm just curious about it. So H.R. 2220, you sit on an immigration committee, immigration reform.
I don't, actually.
Subcommittee? Or
no.
It's listed on your website.
It's not. I'm on transportation and armed services.
Okay.
I'm not on immigration.
It's still on your website, your House website, it is, as of yesterday.
Roger, Mr. Kimber.
Okay.
Whatever you say.
But I did hear you last year when I asked about immigration reform, and I've heard you talk a lot about border security, and I'm just curious, this bill, which has been sponsored by many of your colleagues, mostly the state border, so Texas, Arizona, California, and again, I know that's one of your big stances, border security, so what are you doing more about that? I mean, I've read the bill, and although, I mean, it's only sponsored by Republicans, there are many things in there I would support as well. The question is, since border security is one of your biggest stances, why haven't you as well as co-sponsored this, and why aren't you working with the Democrats? Because I know I've heard you say you don't want to talk about immigration until the border is secure. Okay, then what are you doing to secure the border?
30-second rebuttal, Mr. Hunter.
Yeah, sure. Number one, you can't just pull one of these bills. There's a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of things. I don't know what H.R. 2220 is. But if I was prepared for that, I could ask you some things that you probably don't know about too, right?
Sure.
So here's what I would say. If you just secure the border and you don't have anything in interior, meaning you have no interior security, you have no E-Verify system, just doing the southern border doesn't do anything. But if you secure the border first and you put in these systems, then the immigration debate kind of goes away. Because in that fantasy land, the border is secure forever, meaning in 10 years you're not going to have 20 million illegal aliens in this country that have come over, because the border is now secure. So then we can look at the immigration issues that we have. The problem with that House bill and other bills like it is that they don't put border security first. And I don't trust the Senate or the House of Representatives to put border security before the other types of amnesty that they want to put through. Security first, then we'll work on the immigration stuff.
Carson Hunter, I think you're going to like my next question. I wasn't going to ask this because it was similar to this question we had before, but I think there's a lot more we need to talk about in this one. So another question was, what is your solution to the problem of immigration in this country? Mr. Kimber.
You have 10 seconds.
No, good. Thank you. Okay.
That would be 15. Thank you.
Well, okay, to start, I do support DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I mean, we have a lot of people that were brought up here not of their own volition, yet they've been educated in our schools, they've gone to our colleges, and I've heard people say, well, they've done it at the taxpayers' expense. So as Republicans say that they're very fiscally conservative, very fiscally responsible, why would you want to throw away that investment? I mean, these are people who have shown their passion to be an American, so I think you start with the children that are brought up here first. But, I mean, immigration reform in itself is not just a one fixed issue. I mean, there is H.R. 15, which a colleague of yours, Representative Dunham, has signed on to. It is a bipartisan bill which does deal with this. And he himself has stated that he believes in a pathway to citizenship. So he, too, lives in an area that is the demographics. There's a high Latino population in his district, as is in yours. So the question is, why aren't you doing more? Why haven't you signed on to that bill? I mean, we talk about bipartisanship.
Mr. Hunter.
You asked him how he would solve immigration, and he asked me a question.
Yes.
I still didn't hear the answer.
I support DACA.
So here's what you do. What you don't do is let people in line in front of people who want to become legal immigrants. That's what you don't do. You don't leave the southern border unsecured. That's what you don't do. You have to have a secure border. You have to have E-Verify. So once again, you can make sure that every single person working in this country is an American citizen. You have to go through all of those different waivers for visas and different visas and make sure that we don't have people here who want to harm Americans. The main point of border security right now, in my point of view, especially with ISIS, is national security. It's a national security issue. You worry about the immigration issue afterwards. But if you have a horrible event like 9/11, and it's not done by Americans, it's done by people who have overstayed visas or got here through the southern border, maybe then we can finally secure it and realize it is a national security issue. But that's how you fix it. Don't overcomplicate it. Secure the border, have E-Verify implemented, check out all of those visas, and it will sort itself out, and then we can work the immigration issue it's secure.
Your rebuttal?
I would disagree that it just sorts itself out. I mean, assuming a problem will just go away if you fix something else. I agree with the border security and E-Verify, but I don't know how that resolves certain problems. Again, to go back to the deferred action childhood arrivals, are you telling me that people who have been here since the age of 5 or 10 even, that they've gone through our schools, been educated, that they should get to the back of the line or go back to a country that they don't even know?
Mr. Hunter, you have 30 seconds.
Number one, you should make what you should want, because you're running for the House of Representatives, is you should want that debated in front of the American people by Congress and the House of Representatives. We did not debate that. That was a unilateral action done by this president that some have seen as illegal. The president doesn't get to say, this used to be against the law, but now it's okay. That is something that should have been discussed in light of day in front of the American people by Congress, and then we can vote on it, and then you could hold somebody up here accountable. Mr. Kimber just said it's okay if the president does it. That's fine with me. I don't believe that.
Actually, no, that's not what I said. But
that's what happened with DACA.
2 years ago, the Speaker of the House.
We're moving on to our next question. Thank you, gentlemen. This will be to Mr. Hunter to begin. This area, this district in particular, is going to be impacted by what's going on in Iraq, probably more than any other place in the country because of the large Chaldean population that is here and Iraqi Christians. One way or another, no matter what happens on the ground, there are going to be a lot of refugees. What should be the federal response to the crisis which is brewing right now and to the people who will be coming here looking for refuge from the crisis in Iraq?
Me first.
Starting with you.
Okay, number one, going again. You have to strike ISIS wherever they are all the time, and you're probably going to have to do it in perpetuity. Radical Islam will be a threat for me, for my kids, for their kids, in forever and ever. That's what radical Islam, you had somebody in Oklahoma chop off a woman's head today. Okay, that was an Islamist, a radical Islamist murder. You're going to face this forever. You're going to have to maintain a force there so we can kill the bad guys whenever possible and make sure that they can't attack us here. You have to give humanitarian aid to Kurdistan. Kurdistan's taken all these refugees, Jordan too. We owe them that. Through the World Health Organization and the UN, we ought to be providing some humanitarian relief. We ought to be arming Kurdistan. We ought to be arming the Peshmerga so that they can take these guys out on their own, and you don't have to have American troops there. But that takes us supporting them. You got to put pressure on Turkey. Turkey should not be able to aid and abet the ISIS folks. You have ISIS folks going into Turkey, and this is not official reporting, but just word on the street that I have from the Kurdish community here. You ought not have ISIS folks getting help in Turkey, getting medical help in Turkey, and being able to rearm and refit and go back and fight from Turkey. So those are a few things I think that need to get done that don't include training more Syrians to fight other Syrians.
Mr. Kimber.
Okay. I understood the question, though, to be about what we're going to do about the refugees specifically. Okay. I know one of the things that can be done has to do with essentially the numbers that are assigned to who can come into this country. And part of it is those numbers apply to the whole family, whereas the numbers should just apply to the sponsor themselves, whereas their immediate family members are not included in that number. I know that certain local leaders are looking to raise that number, and I think part of the reason we created part of this problem, so we do owe these people. We are responsible for this. We need to take responsibility.
Mr. Hunter, 30-second response.
Sure. We have legislation that I'm already on, in fact, with Juan Vargas, a Democrat from South Bay, that does this. It raises the caps for Iraqi and Syrian asylees and Kurdish asylees, especially Christians and people that are getting persecuted in that area. So we are doing that, and we recognize that there's a humanitarian need. But in the end, you can't just – America in the end has to take care of itself. And what we should do is help these countries to maintain their own stability and their own forces so that they have a thriving economy. And maybe they can help us one day in 25 years as opposed to the U.S. taking the lead on all these things all the time.
Mr. Kimber, 30 seconds.
No.
Yeah. Move to our next question from Mr. Lynn to Mr. Kimber.
All right. Now that Attorney General Eric Holder is stepping down, do you think the Fast and the Furious Do you think that the Fast and the Furious investigation will continue, and what is your position on that issue?
I think the investigation will continue. Unfortunately, I think there's a term we use in the military called beat a dead horse, and it seems like a lot of members on these committees just continue to go after something. I don't dispute that this was wrong. I don't think it should have been done, but it seems like it's been asked and answered.
Mr. Hunter.
Sure, man. Fast and Furious, talk about beating a dead horse. Fast and Furious is over a dead U.S. Border Patrol. I mean, that's what it's about. When you tie that into Eric Holder, I don't think Holder wants to be in office much longer once the new investigations start. I don't think it's going to change anything. I think this president's going to bring somebody on who's as partisan as he is and ideological as he is. I don't think it's going to change much. But him being gone takes him out of the limelight, and I'm sure Eric Holder will go get a nice cushy law job, making a few million bucks a year, and good for him. Glad he's gone.
Mr. Kimber, 30 seconds.
No.
We move on. Next question to Mr. Hunter from the audience. The Pentagon has officially proclaimed that climate change is of strategic concern to the United States. What do you think, if anything, should be done to address issues related to climate change?
Number one, the Pentagon needs to pull its head out of the sand. Okay? We don't have enough ships. We don't have enough ships. We don't have enough planes. We don't have enough F-22s. We don't have enough people. There are people getting out of the military right now because they're being forced out. But climate change is more dangerous than ISIS. Climate change is more dangerous than nuclear North Korea. Climate change is more dangerous than a nuclear Iran. Climate change is more dangerous than Pakistan. Baloney. This is an ideological partisan push by the administration within the Department of Defense. The military is there to fight and win wars, not play out some social experiment where we force the military to buy algae fuel, buy ships, buy rockets, buy missiles, buy what we need to do to win wars. Don't waste your money.
Mr. Kimber.
Okay, so to your comment about wasting money, we are wasting money in terms of the drought, record drought that we're suffering, the number of fires that we're having. I mean, look at the fires that have happened this year, Escondido, San Marcos, Julian, now the King Fire, and the fire department's already exhausted the amount of money that they use for these emergency services, so they're going to have to get more money, and I'm sure from the federal government. You're talking about a waste of money. Not addressing drought is going to result in a waste of money. You can ignore it all you want, but it's here. Ask the farmers. You live in a district that's heavily agriculture. Ask them what they think about the water drought situation. Ask the Farm Bureau. That's one of their number one issues right now. Now, I've talked to the Mount Helix Water Board as well as Padre Dam, and they're doing water recycling. And these things are – this is what some of the money needs to go to invest in. I don't deny that we need strong defense. We need planes. We need ships. But you can't deny climate change. You just can't do it.
Mr. Hunter, 30-second response.
Once again, Mr. Kimber didn't answer the actual question about the military saying that climate change is our number one threat, because it isn't. There is no answer for that, because climate change is not the number one threat. What I've done in Congress here in San Diego and in Southern California, we built reservoirs. We use federal dollars to build dams. We've done a whole lot on water storage and reclamation. You have desalinization plants going in Camp Pendleton and North County. We're doing a whole lot of stuff on water, and frankly, we're much better off than Central California is here in San Diego because of the steps that we've taken. But that doesn't mean that the U.S. military should take your taxpayer dollars that you're using to make sure that we remain a free country and protect our interests and allies and spend it on climate change in whatever way the DOD feels is the right way to do it. That's a misuse of taxpayer money, and they're wrong to do it.
Mr. Kimber, 30 seconds.
No.
I'm going to invoke my moderator's right to ask a couple follow-ups. First one is for Mr. Kimber. Do you have a plan that would address the issues and solve the problems of the droughts and making that go away? Can you describe what it is?
Well, to make it go away, no. I mean, but my plans, and echo some of the things that Mr. Hunter has talked about doing. As I mentioned, I met with the different water boards, and one of the biggest things that they're doing, which will help, I think, dramatically, is the recycling of water. But right now they're only recapturing about 50% of it, and there is this public perception that recycled water is not safe. I would say, just having been in the military on board a ship, that's what we do. I mean, some of the water is collected through desalinization, and I'm aware of the desal plant. But much of the water that we use for consumption is recycled water, and it is very safe. But we need to make the public more aware of this. In terms of ending the drought, I mean, I can't make it rain, so we just have to continue working on, I think, the recycling is the biggest effort in combination with the desalinization.
Mr. Hunter, 1 minute.
All right. So we have tried in the House of Representatives over and over and over to have San Francisco release the water that they have up there, because it's dammed off for that little fish, the Delta smelt. You have an entirely dry Central California. Talk about farmers going out of business. It is dry now. There are signs saying, thank you, Pelosi, for the Dust Bowl, as you drive through Central California, because Nancy Pelosi has created, there is an actual drought, but she has created a water shortage in what used to be the breadbasket of the United States, and it no longer is. It's dry, because they care more about the Delta smelt than they do people, and I mean most Democrats do. That's why they destroy economies, and that's why you have a Dust Bowl system in Central California. And I mean Democratic policies.
My second follow-up is for you, Congressman. You mentioned that you don't believe that climate change is the largest threat the Pentagon should be worried about. Do you consider it to be a serious threat?
I think climate change is going to be happening. It was happening millions of years ago, and it's happening now. So let me give you an example. There is climate change. I don't dispute that. I think that the climate is changing, and I'm not saying that the weather's changing. I believe in actual climate change. The question is, are we the ones causing it? We live in a relatively cool time on Earth right now. When you look back millions of years, if you look back millions of years, we live in a relatively cool time. The temperatures on Earth before there were humans, on Earth have both been higher, much higher, and much lower than they are now. Humans,
I would please ask the audience to show respect or to go do something else tonight.
So the main question is there human-caused climate change? That I do not buy. Is the climate changing? Is it going to be getting colder during an ice age and warmer during a warmer period? Yes. But I don't think that we're the ones doing it.
Mr. Kimber.
So despite all the scientists that say to the contrary, you want to dispute what they have to say. I mean, it's... I work in neurosurgery. I'm a physician assistant, and I would just say, I mean, if 98 doctors tell you have a brain tumor and need surgery, you don't want to listen to the two that say don't. But that aside, okay, let's just say, for argument's sake, I'll agree with you, and just let's say it's cooler now than it ever used to be. What's wrong with taking steps towards addressing climate change, such as alternative energy, such as recycling water, recycling, getting electric cars, building these power stations for the electric cars? What's wrong with approaching that? These will provide jobs. They will create jobs. What's wrong with approaching it from that viewpoint if you just want to not believe in climate change?
Right. The next question comes from me to Mr. Kimber. Citizens United, good decision, bad decision?
Terrible.
With explanation, if you would, what should be done about it?
I think we've all seen, you know, the amount of money that's flowing in as a result of Citizens United has really, I can't think of a nice word to say how it's really tainted. Okay, I'll use that. Tainted the political system. It, you know, I hear this over and over how it's all about the money. And in, to some extent, I guess it is nowadays. I mean, you can go ahead and donate to certain PACs now, unlimited amounts, and without any identification of who's making these donations to some committees. And, you know, unlimited contributions are going into campaigns, and it seems that more and more are from corporations. I know, Mr. Hunter, a lot of your contributions come from the the committees that you sit on, such as the shipbuilding, some companies like that, some of the defense industry are also big contributors in your campaign.
Mr. Hunter, 1 minute.
So I think it was the right decision. We live under the U.S. Constitution. People can believe in what they want to believe in, and they can spend as much money as they want to spend on what they believe in. How else do you have millionaires like the owner of Facebook and others doing these, putting tens of millions of dollars into their immigration pushes or their global climate change? You know, Leonardo DiCaprio puts in tens of millions of dollars towards his climate change stuff. You all think that that's fine. But when Republicans do it or conservatives do it, then it's bad, evil corporate money. Number one, Congress cannot take corporate money. Congress can't take corporate money. It's illegal. So at the same time, how do you get money out of the influence of politics but recognize that everybody has the right to do what they believe and spend money on what they believe in? I think that the Supreme Court had to make a decision. They made the right one. It'd be nice if there was some middle ground where you could spend as much as you want but not have that money influence the races in any bad way.
Mr. Kimber.
I would agree. And, you know, you say that it's okay when it happens for Democratic, such as immigration reform or climate change, and I disagree. It's not okay there either. I think it should be a level playing field. I would take it away, and it should apply to both. I'm not singling out one party or the other as being the guilty. They're both culpable in this.
Okay. Mr. Hunter?
Sure.
On a relatively agreeing note, we move into our final candidate statements. Before we do, I always like to tell audiences whenever I have the chance, I'm a professor, I'd like to talk, that we're here to promote civil discourse because, you know, civility politics, if you go to the Greek word for it, is turning the poly, the many, into the polis, the community. And the Greeks used to consider those who pursued the good of the community to pursuing the highest good to be the most noble amongst themselves. I don't remember hearing a lot of people say that politicians are noble. When they are doing the work, the rest of us have not. I would like to say to both of our candidates, I really appreciate and honor the work you do, and I would like the audience to give them a nice round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you.
On that note, we will have 3-minute closing remarks followed by 30-second responses. As long as the candidates would like to do their 30-second responses or until our host asks us to leave. We begin with Mr. Hunter.
Hey, first off, thank you again. Thanks for doing this and taking time. And to all of you, whether obviously there's a few of you who may disagree with me, but thank you for being here too, because truly that's what this is all about. And the fact that you came out on a Friday, thank you for doing it. I want to thank my son and two daughters for being here. I have to go to all of your stuff, so now you have to come to my stuff. Mom, my mom's here, and my lovely wife is here. Thank you very much. And all of my friends and supporters and those who don't, thank you very much for being here. You know, I said it in the very beginning, for our system of government to work, we have to be able to govern ourselves better than those who would wish to govern us can. That makes sense? Meaning we control our own destiny. We govern ourselves. The federal government does not know what you need. A one-size-fits-all federal plan, 3,000 pages or 5,000 pages of legislation, still doesn't know what you need as Americans. The way that we thrive in this country is we have the opportunity to do whatever we want to do within the bounds of good judgment, law, and order. That's what makes us entrepreneurs. That's what makes us go out and do amazing things. And it's because of regulation and that burdensome regulation and the unaccountability. Because you can't hold me responsible anymore because all this stuff is being done by the Environmental Protection Agency. It's not Mr. Kimber. It's not me. It's these bureaucracies that are tearing down the American way. In California, it's the bureaucracies that are destroying commerce in the state. That's why you see business after business after business leaving California. Because there's other states in which it's much easier and much more profitable to do business. That's because regulation kills. And we got to break out of that. We got to bring our corporate tax rate down. Bring these countries back from China and India. Get them back here in the U.S. Make American goods. And then us Americans, we can go buy those American goods and make sure that our neighbors and our family have good jobs because there's manufacturing back in this country. The number one job, I think, the number one job that I have as a U.S. congressman is national security. That's it. Because all of this other stuff, everything that we've talked about here, everything from climate change to immigration, none of that matters if we get hit again like 9/11. None of that matters if we get hit again like 9/11. That is the federal government's number one job, is to make sure that the people in this country and our allies are safe from harm, and that we don't get attacked, and that we're not attacked overseas. I actually believe that the federal government has overstepped its bounds in almost everything that there is, but there are a few things that it does well, and that's one is national security, the other is transportation and infrastructure. We can build big bridges pretty well. The federal government can, because they're big jobs. Those are things that the federal government should be doing. What we should not be doing, education. Let the communities, let the families and the cities and the counties handle things that they where they know what is best for their citizens. Because there's people sitting back in D.C., they don't know. Thank you very much. Mr. Kimber, thank you for being here. I appreciate it. God bless you all.
Mr. Kimber, 3 minutes.
Sure. I want to thank again our host Veterans Campaign, thank our moderators here. And again, Mr. Hunter, thank you for this opportunity. I want to thank the guests who have come here this evening that have supported me over the past few years. As never having been in elected office, most of you I've met for the very first time and never would have met otherwise if it had not been for this opportunity. I've met people, both Democrats, Republicans, and all have welcomed me, maybe not some as much as others, but I've really enjoyed the chance to get to know many of you, sit down and talk to you about what the issues are that bother you the most throughout this district that you live in. I agree with Mr. Hunter that the government is not here to tell you how to live your lives or to fix your problems. But those who are elected do have a job to do, and that's not an excuse for not doing the job. It's not an excuse for not addressing things such as climate change, for not addressing immigration reform, for not addressing health care. National security is absolutely paramount, but these other problems are not any less important. And I would like to work with you to help with these issues if I am elected. Again, just because government is not there to solve your problems doesn't mean that they shouldn't be doing the jobs that they were elected to do. Okay. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate everybody who came out this evening.
Seconds, if you'd like.
No, I think you finished very well.
Gentlemen, shake hands. Thank you all very much for coming tonight.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks so much. One last comment before we go. I just want to thank both of our participants tonight. Veterans Campaign's philosophy is that if we have more veterans getting involved in running for office and being involved in public service, that will lead to more civil discourse. And when I talked to my bosses about whether we should sponsor this debate, they said, yeah, well, what if it doesn't actually do that? And in this case, I want to thank both of you guys for really having a terrific debate on the issues. Not agreeing on everything, but it certainly did not lead to ad hominem attacks, which we need more of. We need less of, excuse me, in D.C. these days.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Brian Boyko, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.